So last week we kicked off a series we've called I Still Do. And we started with talking to primarily to singles, but this is, kind of the name implies that it's a marriage series. And so we're going to be continuing talking a little bit more, transitioning into marriage today. So I thought I'd start with something that I think is really important to all of us, and that's food. So I thought I'd start talking about food a little bit. So I've got a picture up here. I don't know about you. I'm not much of a cereal guy, I'll be honest. Partly it's because I can't have milk, so cereal is kind of lame without milk. But so this is, I don't know, probably pulled from an advertisement of Cheerios or something. I'm not 100% sure. But they make a picture like this, and maybe you see it on a box. Maybe you see it as a part of a video and a commercial. And we get to look at this, and it builds up our expectations for the cereal. Because you're never going to see in advertising a bad picture of food. They want to make it as appetizing as possible so that you look at that and you're like, man, I hope it tastes as good as it looks. And so you look at that. But here's the thing. Food is really difficult to take pictures of because it never does exactly what you want it to. And so cereal, for example, as soon as you throw cereal into milk, it starts to get soggy. It soaks up all the milk. And it discolors the milk, and I mean, within 10 minutes, cereal doesn't look very appetizing anymore. And it might take you longer to get your studio all set up around the cereal than the 10 minutes it takes to get all soggy and stuff. So there are tricks that professional food photographers use to make food look more appealing. And so, like this picture, for example, So this picture, for example, that's not actually milk. It's glue. So they filled up a bowl nice and full of glue, threw a little bit of cereal on top of it, but it looks like what it's supposed to be, but they're building up our expectations on something that's completely false. So the next one, we got some ice cream up there. But ice cream is also notoriously difficult to take pictures of because it gets under those hot lights of a photo studio and it melts almost right away, and then you're taking pictures of soup. And so that's not actually ice cream. It's food coloring, a lot of really intentional design, and a couple scoops of lard. So it's not even ice cream that we're getting a picture of. So next one, pancakes. And you're probably wondering, what have they done to these poor pancakes? That is one whole pancake. But then the rest is just like the outer layer or the outer ring of pancakes. And most of that, because pancakes sag and they soak up the syrup right away and they get a little mushy looking. And so it's mostly cardboard in the middle to give it that nice fluffy springy look. And then a little bit of pancake around the outside. And then once again, the pancakes soak up syrup really quickly. So it's hard to take a picture of syrup. And so instead of syrup, that's motor oil. So they just cover it in motor oil, and it looks like syrup, I guess. So, okay, I only have one more, I promise. So this is a burger. Looks like something you'd find in next to the food in a menu at a restaurant. But when they take pictures of burgers, typically what they do is they don't actually cook them. They just sear the outside a little bit, so it doesn't look raw. And then they cover it with shoe polish. Because shoe polish looks a lot like, I don't know, it gives it that coloration a little bit. And then in order to give it the nice grill lines, that darker color, they'll just paint on a little bit of a paint stripper. And that's how they get that grilled look on there. And so you see a picture just like that one, and you think, man, that looks good. And it builds up your expectations for what it's going to look like. And you see it in the menu, and you're like, that burger looks amazing. I bet it's going to taste amazing. And you order it, and it comes to the table, and then this is what it looks like. And so they build up your expectations, and then your expectations, whether they are good or bad, kind of dictate what you think of the meal, at least on arrival. And so we have expectations about more than food. We have expectations about every part of life. Whether it's like when we set a schedule, what you're saying is, this is what I expect out of my day, or this is what I expect out of my week or month or year. When you have expectations when you wake up in the morning about how your job is going to be. We have expectations about what the church service is going to be like when we wake up on Sunday morning. If you, like, there's nothing quite like, you know, knowing you have a lazy day coming up. And even in a day of I plan to do nothing, we still have expectations. And so we have expectations about everything, and marriage is no exception. Marriage is no exception. We have, I think that's pretty obvious on the day of the wedding. We spend all this time leading up to the wedding, and we have all these expectations about what we want the day to look like. And we want everybody to be smiling, and the flowers are going to show up on time, and the photos are going to turn out amazing. And maybe for some of us, like, that was our wedding. Like, everything pretty much met our expectations. Or maybe that's the opposite, and you're one of those, like, wedding fail videos. And so we have all these expectations, and they continue into marriage. And expectations, I think, are particularly powerful in the first few years of marriage. Because, like we talked about last week, so we kicked off the series with singleness last week, and we said that the foundation of marriage doesn't begin on day one of marriage. Doesn't begin on the day of the wedding or the day of the engagement or even the day you start dating the person you're going to marry. The foundation of marriage, you start building the foundation of marriage in your singleness. You start building the foundation of marriage in your singleness. And so you start building up your expectations for what marriage is going to look like while you're still single. And then once you've been married for 10 years or plus years, however many years, like, those expectations have kind of played themselves out a little bit. You know, and so all those expectations you had of marriage when you were still single, I mean, you hit most of them in the first few years of marriage. And so today we're talking primarily to younger married couples, because there's a surprising number of couples in this church who've been married for like 5 or fewer years. And so if you're single, it's still for you, because you're going to want to take notes, because this may very well apply to you in the near future. And if you've been married for some time, it's still important, because we still have expectations going well beyond 5 years of marriage. We still have these expectations. And so think for a moment, if you're single, what are some expectations you have of marriage? What do you think the marriage is going to look like? How do you picture your spouse? Because we all have expectations of what marriage is going to look like going into it. If you are married, what are or were some expectations you had going into your marriage? What were some expectations that you had kind of built up and you were looking forward to going into marriage? Because we all have a ton of expectations going into marriage. And some of them are really good expectations and have a very right, healthy place in a good marriage. So things like desiring honesty in your marriage, personal integrity in your marriage. The wedding vows are filled with promises and expectations that we're going to be sticking this thing out no matter what happens. Those are all expectations and good, right expectations we have moving into a marriage. Some of our expectations they're not necessarily bad. They're not necessarily great, but we just have to change a little bit. So for example, going into marriage, I had this expectation culture had kind of taught me that in general, women are cleaner than men. And so growing up or in college, having like 3 guy roommates, like, I really hoped that was true, because it was not always fun having 3 guy roommates. And I'm generally a pretty clean person, although my desk might disagree with me. But for the most part, I like to tidy up. And so for the most part, that is true of Chelsea, my wife. But then there's this one thing, and I didn't know this was a reality. One time I walked into our bathroom, and I pulled open the shower curtain and was horrified at this mat of wet hair stuck to the side of the shower. And I don't know, I mean, there were some hands first service, so it's not just a Chelsea thing. Like, apparently some ladies, as they're, you know, like getting the shampoo out of their hair or whatever, like some hair comes out. And you don't want that to go down your drain because, I mean, that's going to haunt you in 5 years. And so they'll like mat it to the side of the shower. And then, you know, over at the end of the shower, they'll like bunch it up and get this nasty wet hair wad and they'll throw it away. Which is actually, I mean, that's a pretty clean way of doing things. But she had forgotten the last step. And so I, to my horror, I opened the shower curtain, and I thought I was in a horror movie, and some like demon-possessed child was about to come out of like this mass of wet hair from the side of our shower. And so that wasn't necessarily a bad expectation, but I had to change it just a little bit because there are just some things I didn't know. I wasn't informed enough for that expectation to continue in our marriage. But then there are some expectations we have that really have no place in a healthy marriage, that we just need to get rid of entirely. So I'll give you an example from my own life. I've been told by my grandpa and my dad that Nepital, my last name, means stubborn. And so you can that kind of gives you a glimpse into what conflict looked like growing up. And so often, I mean, I'll be honest, when I was a teenager, I was probably the instigator most of the time. And so, you know, we'd have a disagreement, and I mean, before long, we were yelling at each other, and, you know, it got pretty bad. And then most of the time, we would separate, we'd go cool off, and then when we came back together, we just kind of pretended the whole thing didn't happen. Like, you know, it was the forget half of forgive and forget. And I'm not saying that's what happened every time, but that's kind of what I remember about conflict growing up. And so when I was, fortunately, this happened when I was dating Chelsea. We were dating and we had a disagreement. It was something silly and little, but some feelings were hurt. But then because of our schedules, we had to separate. And we came back together. And, you know, I was operating under my expectation of how to deal with conflict, which was we weren't going to bring it up. And she said, "So are we going to talk about this?" And I thought, well, no, we're not going to talk about this. That's not how you deal with conflict. And then it kind of dawned on me. I was like, maybe that's not such a healthy thing. And fortunately, I recognized that early. Long before we were even married, because I shudder to think what would have happened 10 years into our marriage if I still thought that the best way to handle conflict was to pretend it never happened to begin with. Because there would be no forgiveness. There would be no genuine apologies. There would be no real reconciliation whenever something cropped up in our marriage. And so I'm incredibly grateful and thankful that I recognized that expectation I had early and recognized that that had no place in a healthy relationship. And so there are some things that they have no place in a marriage or in a relationship. And so I think there's one in particular, and our culture just feeds off this idea. There's this one idea and expectation that our culture has going into relationships. And there are a number of movies and TV shows where this is the core premise of the entire thing, or at least, you know, a major plot point. And that's this idea of the one. So and here's the funny thing about the one. It's really poorly defined what we mean when we say that. Like, you say it, like, for example, I've watched How I Met Your Mother probably 3 times, the entire series, and that's the whole premise of the show. Like, Ted Mosby, the main character of the show, is on this epic adventure to try and find the perfect woman for him, the one. And yet, I don't think they ever stop to define what he really means when he says he's looking for the one. Like, he'll list some attributes every now and again, but they never really, like, they just kind of assume that, oh, the one, everybody knows what he's talking about. And yet, I think it's important that we unpack what that means just a little bit, because I think the implications are really dangerous. And so what we mean by the one is that there is someone out there, a man or a woman out there for us, that they're just the perfect fit. Their strengths match our weaknesses. Our strengths match their weaknesses. We just have all these things in common. We like the same things. We dislike the same things. We love the same kinds of movies. We like the same hobbies. We're just going to enjoy hanging out all of the time. They are wildly attractive, and they are going to stay that way forever. And that's the idea we have of the one. That there's this person out there who's basically going to complete me. And that's going to be their job. For all the dark spaces in my soul, all the lonely moments of my life, their purpose in my life is to fill those in and make me feel happy and fulfilled. And that is an impossible burden. In our search for the one, we place an impossible burden on our spouse or our boyfriend or girlfriend or whoever. That is a burden that only Jesus can fill. That satisfaction can only be found in God, only be found in Christ. And so when we look to another person to do that, it causes all kinds of chaos. All kinds of chaos. And eventually one of two things is going to have to happen. Because basically what you're saying is, like, let's put happiness, for example. If you look to another person to be the primary source of happiness in your life, this person, I want to find a person that just makes me happy. Because people are fallen, eventually they're going to make you sad. They're going to make you angry. They're going to make you any number of all those emotions that are the opposite of happy. And what do you do in that moment? Because if their role, if their job is to make you feel happy at all times, then in that moment, and in many moments to follow, they are failing at their job. And you have two options. Either you break up or divorce them. You get rid of them. Because they just must not be the one. Right? If the one is supposed to make you feel happy, and happy is just one piece of it. If they're supposed to make you feel happy all the time, and they're not making you feel happy, then you have to get rid of them because they're not the one. And the next one's not going to be the one either. Or the one after that. You're not going to find that in another person. Or, and this might even be worse, you're going to stay together, but every time they make you sad, because it's going to happen a lot, you're just going to kind of be disappointed. You're going to feel a little gypped and a little cheated because they're not doing their job. And it's not, I mean, it's not happening often enough for you to get rid of them altogether, but you're just going to kind of live with this sense of disappointment at the person you're with. And they're going to feel that disappointment just radiating off of you. And they're going to feel really insecure. And they're going to feel just like they don't measure up. And so possibly even worse than just trading in this person for the next person on a continual search for the one is sticking together and expecting something out of someone way more than they can give. So have you ever found yourself in one of those two places? Either the person who is with somebody and they don't measure up. Not like legitimate things that are red flags that, you know, you don't want in a relationship, but like just little things that are easily forgivable and yet just kind of cause a sense of disappointment in you. Or have you been with someone who you just constantly felt like you didn't measure up, like they were expecting something out of you that was more than you could give? Because at the end of the day, only God can fill that constant need for ultimate satisfaction and fulfillment. And men make terrible gods. And women make terrible gods. We're not meant to fill that role, and we're not meant to fill that space. And so then we'll look at, we'll even go to Scripture, and we'll see things that we feel like fit, you know, what we're looking for. Sorry, this is a little awkward, holding a mic and trying to hold this. So we'll read things like Philippians 2, and we'll read, is there any encouragement from belonging to Christ? Any comfort from his love, any fellowship together in the Spirit? Are your hearts tender and compassionate? Then make me truly happy by agreeing wholeheartedly with each other, loving one another, and working together with one mind and one purpose. And we'll look at something like that. And those are good things, good expectations, good things to desire in a marriage and from your spouse. It's a good thing to want compassion and love and unity from marriage. But when we focus on what we're looking from marriage, then we miss what Paul says next. And so he continues on in verse 3, and he says, don't be selfish. Don't try to impress others. Be humble, thinking of others as better than yourselves. Don't look out for your own interests, but take an interest in others too. And so what if instead of spending so much time on what we're looking from others, what we need from our spouse, what if Jesus is telling us that we need to focus more on what we can be for our spouse? That it's less about trying to look to someone else to be that sense of satisfaction and be that sense of fulfillment and joy and happiness that we're looking for. And maybe it's about, in turn, trying to be a little bit of that for them. Not perfectly. Like, we can't take the role of the one that we place on someone else and then just shift it, read this and shift it and put it on ourselves. Because that's going to cause equal amounts of chaos, because then we're going to be the ones who are failing to live up to that standard. But getting rid of that altogether and saying and acknowledging that we're going to mess up, that both of us are going to mess up, there's going to need to be forgiveness and reconciliation in that. But that we are going to try and humble ourselves and with a servant's heart try and serve our spouse. And this isn't just for married people. This is for everybody. This call towards humility, call towards being a servant is for everyone. Because the reality is everybody's looking for the one. And it might not be in another person. Not everybody's looking for a relationship to fulfill them. Some people are looking for a job. They look for their ultimate satisfaction and fulfillment in a job. They're just looking to this job to give that for them. And they're not going to find it in a job. And some people are looking towards money and power, and they're thinking that that's going to fulfill them. If they just get a little bit more, then that'll do it. They think that a little bit more of what already hasn't satisfied me will satisfy me. And that's just not how it works. And so we often get caught up in this, but as Christians, we're supposed to be looking to Jesus for this, for Jesus to be the one. That when everybody else is looking for the one, what we really need to show them is that they're really looking for Jesus. And this is a call on every Christian. But marriage is uniquely equipped to do this, inherently. I'm going to skip around just a little bit, but I'm going to read a couple pieces of Ephesians 5 just to get a little glimpse of this. I'm going to start in 21. It says, of husbands and wives, so this is in marriage, and further, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. For wives, this means submit to your husbands as to the Lord. I'm going to skip down a little bit. For husbands, this means love your wives, just as Christ loved the church. He gave up his life for her. So we get this unique picture of what marriage is really about. That marriage is ultimately not about just the two people who are in it or the kids that they might have in that marriage. That marriage is ultimately a reflection and a model of Christ in the church. Marriage is at its very core meant to model the relationship of mutual submission, of love and respect that exists between God, between Jesus and his church. That marriage is supposed to be a reflection of that, a model of that. I've heard it said, I don't know how biblical it is, but I've heard it said that your life might be the only Bible that some people ever read. And there's a degree of truth to that. What if your marriage is going to be the closest thing to the gospel that some people ever see? What if they're going to see your marriage and they are either going to see a reflection of Christ and the church or they're not? What if they look at your marriage and see, as imperfect as it is, it's not a perfect reflection, but what if they look at your life and they see such an attractive picture of Christ and the church that they are drawn to that because they are being drawn by the good news, the gospel itself? What if they look at your marriage and they see the way you love one another, they see the way that you submit to one another and show respect to one another, and it draws them towards Jesus? That's what marriage is supposed to be about. In summary of that section, in verse 33, he says, "So I say again, each man must love his wife as he loves himself, and that the wife must respect her husband." It's interesting that he gives two different commands, that to husbands, he gives the command to love, and to wives, he gives the command to respect. Not that wives are off the hook for loving and husbands are off the hook for respecting, but he does give two very specific commands. And so some research has actually been done on this, and there's one study in particular. They surveyed 7,000 people and asked them a series of questions. But what they were really getting at was love and respect, this idea. And this is what they found out, that 81% of men said they would prefer feeling unloved than disrespected. That men kind of run on to a degree, not that they don't want to be or feel loved, but that the fuel they kind of run on in marriage is feeling respected. And then they asked the same question to women, and 72% of women said they would rather feel disrespected than unloved. That the fuel they're running on is feeling loved. And so it's not a coincidence that these two things agree and that the Bible is telling husbands, love your wives, because that's what they're desiring, that's what they're looking for, that's the fuel that they run on in marriage. And wives, respect your husbands, not some like weird distorted picture of power inequality, but the simple reality that that's what they're looking for, that's the fuel that they run on in marriage. And so this command goes out to both, but then there's this interesting reality. In the study, they called this the crazy cycle. And here's what happens. When men feel disrespected, they tend to respond in ways that aren't loving. And when wives feel unloved, they tend to respond in ways that aren't respectful. And then it goes back and forth. And then men feel disrespected, and so they respond in ways that aren't loving, and wives feel unloved, and so they respond in ways that aren't respectful. And you can see why they call it the crazy cycle. It just keeps going. And it creates all sorts of havoc and roots of bitterness in marriage. And so you can see how that can just keep going and keep going and keep going. And eventually, if that simple, I mean, it really is a simple reality to recognize that what husbands kind of run on is respect. And so wives are told to respect their husbands. And what wives are looking for is love from their husbands. And so husbands are called to that. If we don't recognize that and we allow the crazy cycle to go out of control, then the ultimate purpose of marriage, which is to reflect Christ in the church, is almost unrecognizable. That there's so much dysfunction and so much bitterness happening and so much unloving and disrespectful behavior happening in a marriage that you can't even see Christ in the church in that marriage anymore. And so husbands are called to love their wives, and wives are called to respect their husbands. And so I just wanted to end with a couple practical ways that we can do this better. So I don't know, it wouldn't surprise me if many of you are familiar with this, the five love languages. So the five love languages, there's a bunch of research that's been done, and it kind of determined that there are five kind of primary ways that people feel loved or most loved. And so here are the five. The first one is gifts. So giving and receiving gifts. Words of affirmation. So building up someone with your words of encouragement or whatever, or being built up with words. Quality time. And eventually these are going to be up on the screen too. Quality time. Thank you, Dathan. Quality time, which is, not just like sitting on the couch watching Netflix, but actually doing things together. Acts of service, which is, all about that humility and a servant's heart that we talked about before, and doing something for someone else, something active, doing something for them. And then physical touch. And I don't think I need to explain that one. So these are our five kind of basic ways that people feel loved. And so in regard to love and respect, I want you to think in this way. Speak his or her love language, not yours. Speak their love language, not yours. Because we have a default, one of these five, and we kind of operate out of that. And it might not match up with, in fact, it probably won't match up with our spouse. And this is so I've been married to Chelsea for like 2.5 years, which I realize is like nothing. This is something, I've only learned this in the last 3-4 months, and this has been huge. And it's the reality, so I like bounce wildly back and forth between like three of them, but I kind of operate out of acts of service. And so for me, one of the primary ways out of my default I can show love to Chelsea is, I'll take the afternoon off and I'll go home and I'll clean the apartment. And I'll clean the floors. I hate cleaning the floors. I'll clean the bathroom. I hate cleaning the bathroom. I'll do all the dishes. I'll maybe get a little bit of laundry started, right? Like I'll spend 3 hours in the afternoon doing all this stuff for her. And she'll walk in and she'll like deeply appreciate that I did all this, that I spent all that time. But that's not her love language. And so it doesn't register deeply that she feels loved because I did all of that stuff. And so like her primary love language is physical touch. So she would feel more loved out of sitting close to her on the couch for 10 minutes than 3 hours of chores around the house. Not that she doesn't appreciate that 3 hours is more than 10 minutes, but she feels more loved one way versus the other. And so think about how can you speak someone else's love language, your spouse's love language, instead of just solely operating out of your own? And then one other thing, and this comes from, this is something that Corey down at Impact does, and he knows some counselors that often teach this, and they call it the relationship wheel. And so these are eight different areas that couples can work together on improving, kind of eight different areas of married life, basically. And so here are the eight areas. And basically, they will get together about once a year or it's once every 6 months or so, and they'll go through this list and kind of gauge how they're doing. What are some strengths we have going on in this area? What are some weaknesses we have going on and some things we need to work on? And then they'll pick two or three of them or one or two of them or some number of them and then really spend the next 6 months, year, whatever, focusing on how can we improve in this area in our marriage. And so here are the eight areas: friendships, spirituality, family, finances, education, fun and travel, health and fitness, and intimacy. So we're going to leave those up just for a sec. So if that's something that you're like, hey, those would be good things to talk about, like, copy those down. Because I've found these deeply insightful as to things that we can work on and work towards. So we're going to leave those up there for just a little bit. But I want to kind of end with this thought, or with a couple things. So sorry, single people, no practical application for you this week. But if you're married, do something this week to build up your marriage. So maybe that's discovering your love language because you're not sure what it is. And there are like a million tests on the internet that you can take that'll tell you what it is. Or maybe you can just look and you just know. But discover what your love language is, and then don't keep it to yourself. Share it with your spouse. And maybe you've already done those two steps. And so try and operate out of their love language, not just out of yours this week. And so I've already shared what that looks like in our marriage, but try and do some things speaking their love language, not just speaking yours. And then the last thing, married couples, maybe that's, you know, using the relationship wheel and, you know, this week going through some of those things and identifying some areas that you can work on. And then lastly, just kind of talk about, take stock of how well you're doing at being on mission together. Because the true underlying fundamental purpose of marriage is that it would be a reflection of Christ in the church. And so are people around you, people who know you and know your marriage well, is that being a reflection of the gospel to people around you? Because ultimately that's what the purpose of marriage is. So would you guys pray with me? Dear Lord, I just want to pray for the marriages in this room and in this congregation. I don't think it's coincidence that Satan goes after marriage and attacks marriage. Part of it is because some cultural views and expectations on marriage have left some of our marriages a little vulnerable. But a lot of it is because Satan hates to see people saved. He hates to see people give up their search for the one or that person or thing that will satisfy their souls and look to Jesus instead. He hates to see that. And marriage is meant to be a reflection of that reality. It's meant to be a reflection of Christ in the church. And so, Lord, I pray that you would give us wisdom and ideas and knowledge and everything we need to strengthen our marriages this week, that you would give us things to work on, things to improve on, and just encouragement in it. And for those of us who are still single, Lord, I just pray that you would be building a strong foundation, setting up solid expectations so there'd be so much less junk to work through once we finally do get into marriage, and that we would already have a solid foundation set. And so I just want to pray for our marriages that you would strengthen us, encourage us, and in some areas challenge us. But that ultimately we would be able to better reflect you in the church, that ultimately we'd be able to better reflect the gospel to those around us, that it would build your kingdom. We pray all of this in your name. Amen.